I'm excited about this one. I've got an indie blues double shot for you from our featured artist today, Zach Harmon. And stay tuned for that interview. It comes up right after these songs.
Out, you leave me alone. get so cold.
From his brand new CD, and we've got Zach on the line right now. Hey, Zach, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I'm, you know, hanging in here and having fun. Now,
good.
Now, you know, this is the first time you've been on the show, and I really like to get my fans out there an opportunity to kind of really understand who you are as an artist by the journey that you've taken so far. So kind of give us the story of Zach Harmon.
Well, let's see. I was born in 1957 in Jackson, Mississippi. And I grew up at a time in Jackson, Mississippi, where it was incredibly fertile culturally. It was during the time of the Civil Rights Movement. There was all kinds of exposure to the arts. It was very common to have, you know, B.B. King around, or very common to have Little Milton around, or very common to have Sidney Poitier around, or Harry Belafonte, or Nikki Giovanni. These people were like regular folks around all the time, you know, so there was an incredible exchange of cultural ideas.
Wow, that sounds like a great time. You know, I mean, I'm from that era as well. I'm a little older, just a touch. To me, you're still a youngster, you know?
Yeah, well, tell me that.
So now, what was that moment for you that you you said, you know, this is what I want to do for my career. This is my avocation. What was that moment?
Well, the thing about it, you know, as I said, you know, it was so, you know, culturally rich during that time. And see, my next door neighbor, I had two next door neighbors. One was a lady by the name of Doris Green, who was a music educator. And she was from, the world of big band jazz, you know, and she had friends like Count Basie and Cab Calloway and Duke Ellington and folks like that. And when those folks were in town, they were always at her house, you know. And so, you know, being the little kid next door, you know, she'd always let me come over, and she had all these exotic instruments and all of this stuff. So, it was always a lot of music around, you know. And also, my other neighbor was a guy by the name of Bill Ferris, who started the at Ole Miss, the Southern Cultural Center, I think is what it's called. And Bill Ferris was, you know, he used to go to the Delta, and I guess he was working on his doctorate or something at that time, and he would bring back these Delta musicians, you know, and interview them and record them, you know. And so, you know, I would be the little kid, you know, at the gate, peeking through the gate, looking at everything, you know, and just soaking it all in, you know. So it all started for me around that time, you know. And so I kind of knew, like, around age, I would say around age 10, I was really strongly into music, and I was really, really dedicated to, like, you know, learning my craft and learning how to play. But it was around age, I guess, 15 or 16 when I really knew this is what I wanted to do, when I got an opportunity to get exposed to Jimi Hendrix. And I was like, oh, man, whew, I want to do that.
Yeah, I know. I remember.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about the new release you have out now. Now, when you were getting ready to put this together and you say, okay, I got to get a new release out, what was kind of the concept you were going for? What were you looking to achieve with this new release?
Well, you know, I've never really, I take that back. Only my first release was I looking to achieve anything. And there's a whole story behind it, and I'm going to give you the story first before I go any further with my release stories.
Okay.
When I moved to Los Angeles, I wanted to be the next, you know, Albert King, you know, B.B. King, you know, wanted to be like those guys, you know, and you know, I played. Audition for all the record labels, major labels out there, and nobody was biting. Nobody was taking, you know, because they all said, what you are trying to do is a little bit smaller than what we do. We're doing pop music, we're doing R&B music, you know, and so, you know, the market is a little smaller than what we normally deal with, you know, so. But they said, listen, you're a young guy, and we kind of really like your playing, and we like what you're doing. So I started getting calls to do sessions, you know, and that sort of thing, you know, because they dug my playing, you know. And next thing I know, you know, I was doing more and more sessions, and I was learning how to write music and learning more about the music business, and I was learning about the different areas, you know, the income streams in the music business. And so I started producing records, and, you know, around 1985, I had my first big record was with a group called The Whispers. The record went platinum, and after that it was like, wow, you know, we're off to the races, you know, because I started, all the record companies started calling, and I ended up working for Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones, you know. He was instrumental in moving my career forward, and before I knew it, you know, 15 years had gone by. And I still had not done what I went to Los Angeles to do, you know. And so I decided, hey, listen, let's put a stop to everything right now, and let's get back to what we came here for. And so I recorded my first record. But by that time, I had such a reputation in the music community and, you know, across the country as a writer, producer, session player, that, you know, people, I was concerned about people taking me seriously as a blues man, you know, even though that's what I was, you know, that's where it come from. So, I decided my first record to be a live record. You know, I was going to go into a club and bring a recorder in and record live in the club, and what we got was what we got, you know, because I wanted to show people that this is what I really do. And so we did that, and the record, you know, actually did pretty good. It was called Live at Babe and Ricky's Inn. Babe and Ricky's Inn was the oldest blues club in Los Angeles, you know, so it was like really cool to do it there. And so we got that done. But afterwards, you know, I wasn't really concerned so much about making a statement with each record, because I kind of wanted to hold true to the traditional legacy of the blues, with the blues being basically a news source. You know, so the blues was a reflection of whatever was going on in the community. And so that's what I've done with each record. You know, it's more of a reflection of what's going on, you know. So it's my statement for that.
Okay. Now, you know, what studio did you go to record this? Where did you go?
Let's see. For the Mississippi Barbecue?
Yeah. Yeah, this one.
Okay, now you're gonna kill me because I'm having a senior moment.
That's okay. That's all right.
It's a studio in East Texas, and if you call the name, I'm gonna say yes. But it's an incredible studio that's out in the middle of the deserts. It's in the middle of the largest pecan orchard in Texas, and. Let's see, what is the name? I gotta find the name here. Oh, Sonic Ranch. That's what it's called.
Okay.
But it's got a really, really deep tradition, man. A lot of the rock and roll guys and a lot of the Daniel guys, you know, and blues guys have recorded there. And it's like a really cool place because you actually go and you live there, you know, you stay there and you wake up in the morning and breakfast is ready, you know, and they have like seven or eight rooms, you know, and all the rooms are equipped, you know, with vintage gear and everything. And so it's like really, really cool. It's really old school recording, you know.
Right, right. Now, when you get into the studio, what's kind of the process you like to use when you're recording, you know? And I know you've worked, you know, in so many different genres and so many, you know, as a producer and so on. And, you know, getting into the studio and capturing the right kind of sound is always an art form in itself. Do you like to do it live? Do you like to track it? What's your process?
Well, the thing about it is I have gone back to the root. Okay, I've gone back to recording the way we used to do it back in the early 70s in Mississippi, you know, when we were recording on 4 tracks and 8 tracks and 16 tracks, you know, and you kind of had to play live and you had to get it right the first time, you know, but that was, there was a spirit about recording that way that, you know, can't be matched. And so, and you know, in the 80s and 90s, as a record producer, you know, I'm a multi-instrumentalist, you know, I play several instruments. So, you know, I started getting around doing things, you know, recording each instrument, you know, separately and playing several instruments, you know, on a recording and that sort of thing. You know, and that was cool for that era of music, you know, but what I found was blues is so organic. Blues is like country, man. I mean, it's so organic that it's really the mingling, the co-mingling of the spirits of the players that brings the magic to the recording, you know. So now I have gone back to mixing the different players, you know, and doing it that way because that's what makes the magic happen.
Oh yeah, that definitely is the best way, especially with blues. You need that organic interaction between the musicians, you know, and that ebb and flow of the beat. It's got to, you know, it's got to breathe. You know what I mean?
Right, 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 right. And you know, it's funny. I was having a conversation earlier today with one of my colleagues from back in the day, you know, and we were talking about this very subject, you know, and I was saying to him that, you know, one thing that I learned, and you know, after all these years, you know, you never stop learning, and this is something that I learned from Jim Gaines, you know, perfection is sterile.
Yes.
Life is not perfect. So music has to mirror life. So if you make it perfect, you take all the life out of it.
I agree wholeheartedly. And Jim Gaines is a great one to learn from, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, one of the things I think is important to talk about, especially in the blues genre, is the craft of songwriting. You know, Willie Dixon and Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, they were songwriters first. You know, they created great songs, great textures. When you sit down to write a song, what's kind of your process to get the juices flowing, get the muse in gear?
Well, I like, you know, sometimes I start with melody. A great melody. Sometimes I might start with a great track, you know, but most of the time it comes from a great story. And, you know, I try to write about what's going on, you know. I mean, there's a song that I co-wrote with John Hahn, who writes for Shamika Copeland on the record, that's called Making a Dollar Out of 15 Cents. And you know, the whole story about that is, you know, I mean, and most people can testify to this today, you know, a dollar ain't a dollar no more, you know, and, you know, there's a whole story behind that, you know, and so, I mean, that's where that whole song came from, you know, it's about how the dollar's been devalued, but from the voice of the community, the way the community would say it, the way the community would talk about it, you know, like making right. $1.15, you know, that's what I'm trying to do, you know?
Yeah, I know. I've done that a few times. So I definitely understand.
Hello?
Now,
hello?
Yeah, I'm here. You still there?
Hello?
Yeah, you here?
Okay. Yeah. I lost you, but you didn't lose. Did you lose me?
Nope, didn't lose you at all.
Okay. Good.
Now, you've got all this together, and you know you got great songs, you got a great recording, and you got to get it out to radio. You have to get it out to the reviewers, and you know, kind of create the buzz. And you're working with Betsy Brown from Blind Raccoon. How did that relationship start for you?
Well, it actually started years ago. I met Betsy when I competed for the IBC in Memphis, and she told me what she did, and you know, I had just done my second record, which was The Blues According to Zachariah, and you know, I knew the importance of having someone work the record. I didn't know much about Betsy, but you know, we decided to work together. And man, she brought my career to life, you know, and the result of that was a Blues Music Award.
Nice. Now, you can't argue with those kind of results.
No, you can't. No, you can't.
Now, you know, one of the things that a lot of independent artists are struggling with today is that we're faced with a new reality in the music industry, especially for the independent artist. You know, you go back to the 90s, you know, musicians started to take control of their own product. Worldwide distribution was at our fingertips with iTunes and digital music delivery, downloads. We were creating our own CDs. And now, you know, this digital revolution has spawned a whole new music consumer. There's a consumer now that has no frame of reference of holding a physical product in their hands, and it is now also becoming the thing to not even buy their music. We're consuming more. We're paying for less. And this is kind of a double-edged sword for the independent artists in that there are more outlets to get your music out there, but the revenue streams are much lower. How is this new reality affecting you as an independent artist?
Well, I mean, it has a tremendous effect on everybody. You know, when the information highway was rolled out, and this new music reality came about, I don't think that there was a lot of thought put into the process of how that was going to affect the revenue streams that existed, you know, and that had been in existence for years. I think that the music industry sort of went to sleep on it, because, I mean, there had been slight changes before, you know, changes in format, which had been very positive. And I guess they kind of felt like, hey, you know, we're stronger than King Kong, you know, so nothing can affect us. But the truth of the matter is, what happened was you had a whole new generation of consumers that were given a new way of attaining music. You know, when we grew up, we went to the record store and we would spend hours in the record store just going through records, and then we bought records. Well, these people, you know, this new generation, their point of reference was not a record store. It was downloading music, whether they paid for it or not. And so that became their norm. And as a result, the music, the channels of the music, the different work segments of the music industry, the distribution and the retail part of it and all of that stuff, it all just was destroyed. And so we basically had to start all over again. And so from the artist standpoint, you know, well, we thought that, man, this might be kind of cool because now it evens out the playing field a little bit. You know, we can get out, we can put our own product out, you know, and we don't have to beg for a record company to give us a deal or put our record out.
Right.
And so the thought of that was really cool, but the reality of it was it became so inundated with all of this music that who knew what was what. And so now, you know, it's starting to heal itself, but it's taking time, you know, to find the new revenue streams. And as these new revenue streams are popping up, you know, they don't pay the same as their predecessors. So, you know, everything is still being reinvented. And the only thing that from an artist standpoint that we still hold on to, and what has become more important to us, is now live performance.
Exactly.
So we have to, we don't look to earn a lot of money from records anymore. What we look for is getting bookings and being able to perform live and to tour. That's what it's all about now. And so, you know, but once again, you know, the people, you know, it's educating the people so that they come out and see live music and not just sit at home and listen to recordings.
We see, yeah, I definitely agree with you. And if you go back into the history of the industry, you know, back in the late 50s, early 60s, even up through, you know, the 70s, you know, the artists themselves never really made a lot of money from the actual recordings. The record companies kind of made the bulk of that money.
Right.
You know, they made their money on the road. I mean, that's why B.B. King, you know, when he was alive, he used to do, you know, 300, 250 dates a year, because that was his income stream.
That's right.
And we're going back to that mentality.
That's right.
the exercise now, I think, for the independent artist is to convert that passive listener that's, you know, creating a playlist for their yoga workout or whatever and putting a Zach Harmon track in there and converting that person into an active fan that shows up at a show. You know, because even though live performance is important today, venues are struggling to to stay going. So we need to create a fan base that will show up for live music.
Yeah, and I think we even need to take it a step further, especially for blues and jazz and that sort of thing. You know, there has to be legislation involved that, because this is American classical music. You know, this is the music that we can wholly say that is American. This was created here in America, even though it may have roots in other countries. What we know as blues and jazz was actually formed here in America. So therefore, this is American classical music. And I tell you, I use that term very strongly because, I mean, this is something that, you know, from touring in Europe, this is something that I was told by the European audiences. You know, they some of them refer to blues and jazz as American classical music because they say they look at it the same way that we look at Mozart and Beethoven and that whole thing. And so I think we have to, as a society in America, we have to realize that this is part of what, this is our gift to the world, you know. This is, you know, that's America's largest export. And that's what we're known for throughout the world. So we have to protect it here at home. You know, so I think we need to go a step further. There needs to be some sort of legislation that designates this music as American classical music and therefore designates a special break for those clubs and those venues that feature this music. So that they don't have to deal with the same kind of regulations that a normal venue would have to deal with.
Well, that's an interesting take on it. You know, I think, you know, it would definitely help in the long term. On the short term, though, I think artists need to start looking at the technology that's at our fingertips today and use that technology to attract that fan base, to engage that fan base. We live in an era of the reality show and reality stars, YouTube stars, so on and so forth. And I'm finding that the artists that are gaining success in this new reality of the industry are the ones that are creating a sense of celebrity by using this technology to create that. You know, when a Kardashian shows up somewhere, everyone wants to go and see because of that celebrity kind of mentality. And that's really, you know, what you need to do is you create that sense of celebrity, and then when they see, oh, so-and-so is going to be in town, that they will go see you because they want to see the in-person version of you. You know what I mean?
Right. I agree totally.
You know, and it's interesting because we have so much at our fingertips. The smartphones today are basically a full video production suite, you know, we're carrying around. I know bands that shoot music videos with their phone and, you know, marry it to recorded tracks using editing software on their phone. You know, it's crazy what can be done. And
I agree.
You know, there are, you know, bands that, you know, that do, you know, a cooking show. There's, you know, like Larkin Poe did, you know, they do, every week they do a little cover in their living room and, you know, that got the attention of Bob Seger and it ended up you know, opening for him on his tour,
right,
which kicked off their career. You know, so I mean, that's the new, I guess, exercise for the, you know, the independent artist in how they market themselves. You have to, you have to be social media aware. You have to use the internet as a broadcast network, and your right. image as a reality show. You yes. know, and put up that content that engages that fan base.
Yes, I agree.
Well, you know, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us. And we're going to give everyone out there an Indie Blues Double Shot from Zach Harmon. You guys are going to really like this. I want you to turn this up loud. Screw the neighbors. We're going to have some fun.
Thank you.
Throw on some red. Play me some blues. We're gonna have a Mississippi barbecue. Fix me a drink. You know how we do. We're gonna have a Mississippi barbecue. Throw on some red. Play me some blues. We're gonna have a Mississippi barbecue. Fix me a drink. You know how we do. We're gonna have a Mississippi barbecue.
make it right.
Yeah, my good luck woman.